April 29th, and we have two things on our agenda today, public hearing and work session on HCR 4A and public hearing on HCR 42. We will start with a public hearing on HCR 4A. And with us today we have Michael Tolley and Hardy Myers. Would you both come up, please? Thank you, gentlemen. Attorney General Myers, would you like to go first, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. I just wanted to come by for a moment to commend to you the adoption of this resolution in honor of Bob Straub. It was my privilege to begin legislative service on the very day that Bob became governor of Oregon. And so I had a chance to serve with him for the ensuing 4 years as in his service as governor. But, of course, both during that tenure, but in many ways, even more remarkably, before he became governor, Bob Straub was a truly notable figure in this state, made many, many contributions to the life of this state. And I have to say, I can't remember an individual in public life I've known who I thought was more totally and palpably decent and honorable than Bob Straub. So, again, Madam Chair and members, I would very respectfully urge on you the hearty approved adoption of this resolution.
Thank you. Thank you, Hardy. Appreciate that very much. Any questions or discussions? Michael, go ahead. Please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Chair Kleiner, Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michael Tolley of Southwest Portland. I work as legislative assistant to Representative Mary Nolan, who is unable to be here today because of the House PERS Committee. Representative Nolan is the chief sponsor of House Concurrent Resolution 4, which honors Oregon's 31st Governor Bob Straub, who died last November. In the 144-year history of our state, only 35 men and one woman have been elected by their fellow citizens to the office of governor. One of those men was Bob Straub. He embodied the very best of the state that he served as governor, treasurer, state senator, and county commissioner. He was a rangy, private, and unassuming man who was also a bold and creative leader, and he left a remarkable legacy and is remembered warmly by all who were privileged to know him. Bob Straub was perhaps the most innovative Oregon treasurer ever, transforming stewardship of state funds during his tenure and introducing modern business and investment practices. As governor from 75 to 79, he led the effort that reduced unemployment in our state from 12 to 5%. As chief executive, he appointed more women, minorities, and persons with disabilities to top government positions than any of his predecessors. He compiled an impressive record as a defender of Oregon's beaches and helped redirect funding away from the Mount Hood Freeway to public transit. When his family, friends, staff, contemporaries, and ordinary citizens gathered at the Capitol last December to remember this giant of a man who did so much for the state, his fellow governors, past, present, and soon to be, spoke of the Bob Straub that they knew. And I'm just going to read quotes from two of them. Victor Attia recalled that Bob Straub was a doer, not a talker. In his vision for Oregon, he knew what needed to be done and just went about doing it. And our current governor, Ted Kulongowski, listed characteristics he believed described Bob Straub: independent, intelligent, honest, a dreamer, opinionated, at times an agitator. He could be argumentative. He was a businessman, a public servant, a humanitarian. He was a conservationist and a very, very funny man. This is the man that House Concurrent Resolution 4 honors, Robert William Straub, builder, developer, farmer, rancher, family man, and public servant. Urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Any questions? Any discussion? Close the public hearing and open a work session on HCR 4A.
Madam Chair, I would move HCR 4A to the Senate floor with a D-pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves HCR 4A to the floor with a D-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? If not, so moved. close the work session on HCR 4A, and Senator Brown will be the carrier. We'll open a public hearing on HJR 42A. Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Co-Chair, HJR 42A is a would be a ballot measure. Upon approval by voters at the November 2004 general election, it would amend the Oregon Constitution to allow the Senate to confirm judges appointed by the governor to the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, or Circuit Court. I say allow because after receiving notice of a judicial appointment by the governor, if the Senate does not take action on the appointed judge within 120 days, it allows the qualified appointee to take office without confirmation.
Thank you. First, we have Judge Gillette. Would you come forward, please, and introduce yourself for the record? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator Clarno, members of the committee. I'm Michael Gillette, an Associate Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, here to ask that the committee not approve HJR 42A. I find myself in a position I'm in a couple of times, and that is I end up appearing before the proponent of a measure, which puts me in a funny spot trying to anticipate precisely what they're going to say. As it happens, that I've had extensive discussions with Representative Patridge about this measure, trying in my usual refined and reasonable way to talk him out of this and achieving what my refined and reasonable way usually achieves, nothing at all, as it rolls ahead. So I find myself in a place to position of asking you not to approve the matter. My comments will be reasonably quick, and I just want to put the matter to you this way. Oregon, since statehood, has had a method of appointing judges when there was a vacancy during a term for a judge or the creation of a new judicial position, which called for the governor to appoint and then called for the people to decide at the next election whether or not that person should remain, and then every 6 years after to vote on the question again. We have had we've had fools and charlatans as judges occasionally. We've had brilliant men and women occasionally. We've had good people generally. There is no reason to think that the system has not worked well in general, and no system works well all the time. So the real question becomes, is there any pressing need to make a change in what we're doing now? I'm not going to say if it ain't broke, don't fix it, because the question of whether it's broke in any sense is a more political question than a rational question. And I'm in no position to argue the politics of the matter. I tried with Representative Patridge and got nowhere, so I've given up on that point. But I wanted to try to approach the problem in a very slightly different way. Around the country, not just in Oregon, but around the country, at the time that Oregon became a state, the method that Oregon adopted was virtually the universal method of appointing judges. There were a couple of exceptions, and they're kind of fun to know about historically, but basically, this was the way it was done. Since then, in the 150-plus years since then, the modifications that have been made have been designed almost exclusively to remove politics from the process. State after state, for instance, has gone to a nonpartisan judicial ballot rather than have people elected by party. A few states like Ohio and Michigan and, oddly enough, New York and Texas still hold out with partisan ballots. But by and large, there's been a movement away from that. There's been a movement to create judicial appointment commissions whose recommendations to the governor are binding, and then to put the governor in a position where he or she simply must pick from that group in order to take the politics even out of the selection process in that sense. There's been a tendency to try to create circumstances in which judges are appointed and run for retention by themselves without having opposition at all, a position which I frankly think is a mistake, and I think history demonstrates it was a bad idea. But nonetheless, that was an attempt to get politics out of the process. And there's been a movement again and again from the American Judicature Society and others to create what amounts to a lifetime tenure situations in which an appointment is made from a list selected by a blue ribbon commission, and then the person serves on good behavior. In that last example, however, there's been a general recognition that if you're going to do that, then some involvement by the other branches of government is appropriate. And states which follow that kind of approach use either Senate confirmation or legislative confirmation of the appointment, because there's no other check ever. and the idea is that there needs to be a check somewhere. But in the traditional court system, including the way in which Oregon has operated since statehood, the check has been at the ballot box. People closest to the judges who were involved have the best idea how they're doing, have the best idea whether the appointment was a good idea in the first place, and certainly experientially the best idea of how they're doing, and they're in the best position selectively to say yes or no. By and large, they don't say no. By and large, they continue to approve those who've been selected because, by and large, the selections are pretty good. And so I respectfully submit that there's nothing about the history that's involved here which suggests any pressing need to do this or that there's any particular range of experience in the United States that demonstrates it's a better system. I look to try to find out if it's done anywhere. Because in speaking about this on the House side, I said I was unaware of any, and Representative Patridge didn't offer anybody. But I think I found one. It looks as if this is the way Maryland does it, sort of. And I can't tell exactly because I wasn't able to get hold of the Maryland Constitution in time. But Maryland, at least, I just want to be complete about this. Maryland apparently does this. And I can see that there is a principle available, perhaps. It should say, as Maryland goes, so goes Oregon. But I can't begin to imagine why. The only other place that does anything that resembles it is Guam. And
Madam Chair, Maryland does have a baseball team, professional baseball team.
Senator Corcoran, I apologize. I didn't hear all of that. But if you were suggesting that they used to have a professional baseball team, I would agree with you.
The Baltimore Orioles are existent right now.
Yes, but are they a professional baseball team?
Hate arguing with judges.
At all events, Senator Clarno, members of the committee, it seems to me that there's not only no pressing need for this. There isn't any justification for it. The Senate confirmation process simply throws one more step into a process that doesn't need another step. It also presents at least one really serious practical problem, and that is imagine being appointed to a judgeship and facing the 120-day period of review. During that period of time, of course, you have to decide, am I going to run and set up your campaign and so on, but you can't actually look anybody in the eye and say, I'm going to be the judge. Because you aren't yet. And so there are 4 months lost out of the period of time between the appointment and the next general election, whether it's the primary or the general. There's 4 months lost in which a person cannot seriously set up a campaign committee with any kind of confidence with respect to how the process is going to turn out. But that's not a handicap that'll face anyone who wants to run against them. That's a kind of dirty trick. It's hard enough to give up a job in private practice or otherwise with the prospect of undertaking the work immediately and having just to face the election, but to ask a person to face both within what may turn out to be a very short time period, frankly, just isn't fair.
Senator Byer.
Thank you. I'm confused. What would prevent a person in this 120-day time period from setting up a campaign committee? Even if they were confirmed, they'd still run for the office, couldn't they?
Senator Byer, members of the committee, so I assume, and I guess perhaps that would be one answer to it if it weren't for this. You're trying to decide what your status is. And imagine being in a position where you've been appointed, but the Senate rejects you. That's a great position from which to be running for office. I should think that most people would not wish to be a candidate under those circumstances. That is to say, I was nominated, but the Senate wouldn't confirm me. My opponent is, that's the message that's being beaten on the drum every minute for the balance of the campaign. The Senate wouldn't even confirm me. Doesn't deserve your vote. And it's the sort of thing that makes it difficult to get organized to begin with. I think it would, anyway. Now, you know, maybe I'm wrong because the dangerous thing here is I'm making a kind of political judgment and I'm not qualified to. But it's the best guess I can make.
I was going to say, Madam Chairman, nowadays it might actually help to say you were rejected by the legislature. I take your point.
Senator Byer, another question? Okay, thank you. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I don't think anybody wants to move to the Miguel Estrada type of Oregon Senate, but do you think there's any legitimacy to political appointments purely being political by past governors?
Senator Atkinson, members of the committee, I'm the wrong person to ask that because I'm wholly biased. I've been appointed now by two different governors of two different political parties, and so I believe that the the outcome of the process is not necessarily as partisan as it's assumed that it is. Sometimes it's partisan. It's all get out. Frequently it's not partisan at all, and sometimes it's kind of halfway in between. But my sense of it, in looking back at the men and women who've served in judicial positions over the years, and I've been at this long enough, over a quarter of a century, that I've known a whole bunch of them, 300 or 400 of them, they were extraordinarily capable men and women. So I guess my sense of it is that I don't perceive that politics has kept the Oregon judiciary from being top flight. So I guess I'm not bothered by a system which appears to have produced, I'm not claiming I'm top flight, but I'm serving in a system that is, and I don't perceive any reason to worry about that particularly.
Dr. Atkinson, further questions? Anyone else? No, thank you, Judge Gillette. Appreciate
thank
being
you.
Here today.
I don't know about these disparaging remarks about the Baltimore Orioles.
Senator Corcoran, I'll let you take that up privately with the judge regarding the Baltimore Orioles.
I think he's just very biased about it. That's why I didn't even bother talking to him about it.
Representative Patridge, would you like to come up? Good afternoon. If you'll introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Rod Patridge, House District 6, which is in Medford. I appreciate you starting the hearing. I apologize that we were just closing down the public safety subcommittee in Ways and Means and had testimony right in the middle of from Mary Botkin, which went on a little longer, but it was great testimony. I appreciate you taking the bill up for public hearing today on House Joint Resolution number 42, which I sponsored, passed out of the House, and came to the Senate. Part of the reason that I bring you House Joint Resolution 42 is basically what I believe is right now a basic problem in the checks and balances system within the state of Oregon in terms of what happens with the judicial department and how judges are appointed. Currently, judges are virtually appointed for life, though we have a process in Oregon where judges stand for election. The reality of the fact is, if you go back over the history of judges who have been appointed, that very few people have ever run against a judge in the state of Oregon. And frankly, if you talk to local bar members, there is a chilling effect when local lawyers run against an incumbent judge. And I believe that that is a fundamental problem within the current system that we have. In addition to that, there's really the people's branch of the public have no opportunity to vet judicial candidates who are appointed by the governor because of the chilling effect that occurs from a local bar. You know, while in Multnomah County or one of the large counties where there's lots and lots of judges, there may not be as big a chilling effect, but I will tell you in small counties where there's 3, 5, 8 judges, 10 judges, where you have to appear in front of them on a regular basis as an attorney, there is a chilling effect when somebody challenges an incumbent judge and the local judges all rally behind somebody. Currently, the people's branch and the people of Oregon have no opportunity to be involved in the initial appointment of a judge. There's not a balance of power in who's appointed to these judicial positions. For a lot less important positions than judicial positions, we require a Senate appointment. But for judges, we don't. Our judicial system has made substantial decisions over the years which have changed the scope of public policy within the scope of the state of Oregon. And I'm not here to say that, you know, that I think that that's how it can be solved by judicial appointment. But by the same token, I think the people's branch should have the opportunity, because these are virtually lifetime appointments, should have the opportunity to be involved. So consequently, that's why I brought this measure to you. I think that there's a lot of questions, frankly, about, frankly, support overall for the judicial system, sometimes within the legislature. And I also feel like, as the subcommittee chair for public safety, that it also makes, if we do a Senate confirmation of a governor's appointment, it also provides the opportunity for the legislature to buy into the judicial branch, so that we do have some buy-in and we have a lot more support for the judicial branch. And as a lawyer, that concerns me as well. that the People's Branch doesn't have that opportunity, and we don't have as much legislative buy-in. And I think the Senate confirmation could help ease some of that tension that exists as well.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Brown.
Representative Patridge, let me give you a scenario. Let's assume Ron Saxon had been elected governor and the Democrats had taken control of the Senate. Could you talk to me about why you think, under that scenario, judicial appointments would be less political than they are today? Or at least as less political than they are now?
I don't think it matters who the governor is. I think that a minority party interest, whether the Republicans be in control of the Senate or the Democrats be in control of the Senate, would have the opportunity to have a voice and a public vetting of the qualifications and of the individuals who would put their names forward for judge. You know, it's also been argued, too, that qualified individuals may not put their names forward if we had a Senate confirmation. What I would also argue that many individuals do not put their name forward because they do not feel that they have a chance with the current governor, because it's not based upon qualifications. So I think that, you know, I think you can make arguments either way. I think the fundamental question is, should the people in the People's Branch have an opportunity to vet these individuals? That's the fundamental question. I guess I don't understand the question about if we had Ron Saxon or, you know, Kevin Mannix or whoever as a Republican governor.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, one of my concerns is that if the legislature gets involved in overseeing the governor's appointments in the judicial branch, that the process will become more political. You don't agree with that?
I don't necessarily agree that it would become more political. I mean, you can argue both sides of it. The people who are in favor of the current system say, well, it's political already, and we already have people who can run for elections, and they're free elections. So they can't you can't have it both ways. It is a political process in Oregon. The governor runs for political office. Therefore, it's a political officer of the state who appoints somebody. They also have the opportunity to run politically at the local level. So by adding in a Senate confirmation, I don't think it politicizes the process any more or any less. I think it gives the People's Branch an opportunity to look at it. If you want to call that politics, then it's politics.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I may, I think that looking at what's happening at the federal level is a pretty good example. I mean, certainly what happened under Clinton and now what's happening under Bush, I mean, these judicial appointments have become very political. So you may not agree with me.
Madam Chair and Madam Co-Chair, I think that you can say that they are political to some degree. Certainly, you can argue that. That's part of the reason we changed the bill to require the Senate confirmation within 120 days so that you don't have these people held up in perpetuity. We tried to take that into consideration in offering the amendments for this bill in the House. And in regard to, you know, we're all Oregonians, too. We all have to, you know, frankly, I don't think Oregonians would put up if we wanted to highly politicize the process at the Senate level. But now, the only person who is involved in the process at all is the governor's office, and there is no vetting. The issues surrounding candidates for judicial office do not come forward currently because it's all done behind the closed doors of the governor's office, and there's nothing that allows somebody from a minority party, whether you be Republican or Democrat, to come forward to challenge an individual's appointment for judge. And judges, when they run against each other because of the judicial ethics, can't challenge each other. The judicial ethics substantially hinder the ability to even say anything or even raise money to have the ability to say anything during a campaign. I think, as many of you are aware, judges can't even raise money themselves for a campaign. So it makes it very, very difficult for a judicial candidate to challenge an incumbent, and the majority of judges in this state are appointed by the governor, and nobody challenges them.
So, Madam Chair, one more question.
Another question.
And then I think the other argument that I think I hear you making is that we need to have the People's Branch involved because the ballot box is inadequate, or is not an adequate protection of the people in terms of checks and balance? Is that?
I believe that that is correct. I do not believe that election in this state, the way the judicial ethics rules are written currently in the state, the way the chilling effect occurs from local attorneys challenging an incumbent judge because they have to appear in front of an incumbent judge, unlike many other professions or politics in general, as we run for the legislature, anyone can run for the legislature. But as an attorney, you have to have passed the bar. Predominantly for your practice, you have to appear in front of these people. And it's a totally different set of circumstances surrounding a judicial appointment. And I would argue that it is virtually a lifetime appointment in Oregon that goes unchallenged for the most part and is hampered by judicial ethics. And that's why I think we have an opportunity, and I don't think we should restrict ourselves from asking the question, because a lot of the ballot measures that were just on the ballot regarding judicial districts and other things were pretty close. I think the people, and I think they've sent us a clear message, that people would like to be more involved in what's going on, and through the people's branch, through the, your Senate confirmation, you have the ability to do that by passing this bill out.
Thanks. Any further questions? Thank you, Representative Patridge.
Thank you.
Next, we have David Denneke.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is David Denneke, and I am here to urge that you reject this measure. I am an attorney in private practice in Portland. I've been practicing for 25 years. I practice with the law firm of Harang Long Gary Rudnick. I am also a board member of the American Judicature Society, which I know is kind of hard to pronounce. The American Judicature Society is a 90-year-old organization headquartered now in Chicago, and it was founded for the sole purpose of helping the judiciary become better, to help the administration of justice. It was actually founded as a result of its founder, Herbert Harley, who was the victim of some bad judicial decisions in some state, I can't remember where. And he was so upset with the treatment he had gotten by the judiciary that he funded the initial seed funding for the American Judicature Society. The Judicature Society has studied the issue of judicial selection now for 90 years and has a long-standing policy about how judges should be selected nationwide. As Judge Gillette said, not every state follows that process, but one thing that I think we have discovered as a result of looking at every state's system is that every state, and Judge Gillette said maybe Maryland has a system similar to that which is being proposed here, but at least from the Judicature Society's findings, no other state has a process similar to that which is now being proposed. The Judicature Society believes, and I think the people who have looked at this, in at least in our area, would believe that a confirmation plan which is being proposed would serve to further politicize the process, and we think that the process should go toward merit selection, not toward further politicization, if that's a word. The current process seems to be aimed at and seems to accomplish merit selection by and large. There is, in fact, I think, quite a bit of room for input into gubernatorial appointments. You have active bar associations in almost every county which thoroughly vet people who put forth their names for judgeships. You have the legislature itself, which has a place to give input to this process. You have political groups and private groups who take issue with certain nominations or certain contestants for positions, and you have the press. All of them get involved in this process. And, of course, you have the fact that appointees are accountable to the electorate in the present process that we have. Now, the American Judicature Society really doesn't like the elective process, but the fact is that that is a means of getting rid of a judge that the public and does not feel is performing up to par. We also feel that the confirmation process that you're describing, as Senator Brown said, would be a diversion to the Senate and would in fact result in perhaps a system somewhat similar to the federal system that exists. And I think anybody who's been involved in that process or even watched it from a distance realizes how politicized that process is. It would not serve the Oregon judiciary to get involved in a process anything like that. I think another thing that this committee should take into consideration is the fact that if you were to ask the judges of the state what process they favor and what serves the judiciary best, I'm reasonably certain that 9 out of 10 of them would reject the idea of confirmation of judges similar to the process that is being put forth here. I have a few notes on what I understand the process to be at this time, and I think that it is an evolving process. Each governor seems to adopt his or her own process, but it is a process that nonetheless allows for vetting of and scrutinizing of judicial candidates. I understand that most counties now have local bar processes which interview each candidate and rank the interviewees in terms of whether or not they're highly qualified for the job. I understand that the governor has a committee of his own at this point, which has a detailed application process and reference process where anywhere from 5, 10, 15 letters of recommendation are required to be appointed. I understand that there is a process where each of these county bar association committees, which has vetted these people, is able to give their input to the governor's committee. And I understand also that all legislative input in the form of written input, which is given to the governor's office, is read and considered before any appointment is made. One thing that was said by Representative Patridge, which I thought was worth comment about, is the fact that the judicial ethics rules do not provide for a fair contest between the incumbent and a challenger. I think the American Judicature Society has looked at this issue, and the conclusion we have reached is that the judicial ethics process actually works heavily against the incumbent. And I think you only have to look at the situation involved in the election involving Judge Domínguez and the difficulty that he had in defending his record in the press and in public situations. So we urge that you reject this measure and stick with the system we have today. Thank you.
Thank you. I actually have a question. In terms of the judicial ethics, it seemed to me that what Representative Patridge was talking about was that the judicial candidates had an opportunity to discuss behind closed doors with the governor's committee or whatever specific stuff in terms of issues. Don't the canons prevent them from discussing any issues with anyone?
I
don't know.
I'm not an expert on it, but I believe that they would be unable to discuss certainly any issue which is either before them or is likely to come before them.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I may, another question. And then I guess my other is a follow-up on Representative Patrick's comment. And I know that in Multnomah County at one point in time we had a judge that was pretty low-functioning and that it was pretty difficult to beat this judge in an election process. Would you agree with Representative Patridge that a judicial appointment by the governor is an appointment for life, or do you think that's changing?
Well, I don't know the facts and figures as far as incumbents who have been challenged successfully. I know that the elective process is a disincentive to accepting a judicial appointment or running for the office. I mean, it's just not something that most people want to do in order to become a judge. But I don't know how many people have been successful at judicial challenges. I am sure that the press and the bar would jump in and support a challenger who is running against a judge that is low functioning. I'm not aware of exactly what situation you're talking about, but there is certainly an avenue there to challenge such a judge, and I can't see why it wouldn't be successful given the right support and campaign.
Thank you.
Any further questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Tom Kranovich. Did I pronounce that correctly? Is that right?
I don't. That's
good. If you'll introduce yourself for the record this afternoon, and then I'll know whether or not I pronounced your name correctly.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, you did indeed pronounce my name correctly. It's phonetic, Tom Kranovich, and I'm surprised how many people, when they get to three syllables in a last name, just their brain stops. So I really do appreciate that. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. I'm the chairman of the Judicial Administration Committee. Seated with me to my left is Marilyn O'Dell. She's a member of that committee, and with your permission, we'd both like to address this issue. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the Judicial Administration Committee is a diverse group of lawyers. It's made up of men and women. It's made up of civil practitioners, criminal practitioners, by that I mean criminal law practitioners, trial lawyers, transactional lawyers, members of large firms, and sole practitioners. We also have members of large that are not lawyers. We have discussed this bit of legislation, and without exception, it has been opposed by our committee members. The reason we oppose this is that, to use the word that probably isn't word, it does seem to further politicize the process. No one is saying that there isn't any politics in the process right now. But whatever politics there are, they certainly are not a partisan type of politics. We feel that adding the extra layer could make it more amenable to becoming a partisan type of election or appointment process. I'd like to address just very briefly the comments about becoming a judge for life, and I do this because it struck an ugly clung as far as the court was concerned for me, and it obviously bothered Senator Brown. Not everyone feels that getting elected to a judicial position is indeed an automatic getting elected for life. I can state this personally because I'm currently in the process of seeking an appointment myself. And one of the fears that I have is if I do get the appointment, somebody that's got a lot of name recognition and familiarity in the county is going to run against me, and then what am I going to do? I don't have a war chest. I'm not prepared to do that. I think also that the times are changing, that as the public becomes more and more involved in the process, the judicial process, I think we are looking at a time when judges are going to have serious challengers based upon rulings that they have made. I'm not advocating that. I'm not saying it's a good thing. And again, you run into some difficulties because of the limitations that a judge has to defend the decisions that the judge has made. But I believe that the election process is there for exactly that purpose, and I believe, given the nature and interest of our voters in everything nowadays, that there is a strong possibility that challenges are going to be made against incumbent judges. Furthermore, even if we add the extra layer, what does that do away with this notion of being appointed a judge for life? If you're appointed by the governor and you buy the concept that you're appointed for life, then if you're appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate, you're still appointed for life. Nothing has changed. It has not made the election process any easier. This is an extra layer that's being presented. It has the potential to slow down the process of appointing judges. As Justice Gillette said, anytime you get appointed, if you have to wait 120 days, it's not just that 120 days. Because after you finally do get appointed and confirmed or whatever the process is, you still have to wind down your practice. You just can't walk away from 50 to 150 files overnight. So getting judges moved out of private practice, or if they're in the public sector, public practice, into a position where they can take the bench sometimes can be a timely process in and of itself. Extending it by requiring approval process would slow it down even more. We already are short on judges. My home county, which is Clackamas County, has had an opening since February, and there's no action being taken. I suspect there are other counties in similar position. we don't need to add steps that are going to slow down getting judges on the bench when we already know we're short. Even when we have all our appointments filled, we're still short. We have judicial positions out there that have been cut from the budget and counties that need more judges. So we don't need a process that's going to further exacerbate not having judges to sit and hear cases. Beyond merely adding a layer of process to this whole system, I think, again, with the political aspect in mind, one has to keep in mind that in my home county, and I'm sure it's the same in other counties, there are members of the legislature that are vying for those judicial positions. Now, what does that do to the process of approving a candidate for a judicial position? Are you willing to sit in judgment of your own if you have one of your senators that's applying for the process? And how do you keep the politics out of that? I submit that you cannot. Lastly, the point that I would like to conclude with, and I'm not going to do it myself, is how the process currently works and why we feel that it is more than adequate and should be retained. And in that light, I would turn it over to Marilyn. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marilyn Odell. I'm an assistant attorney general. I am not appearing in any official capacity today. I'm merely appearing as a member of the Oregon State Bar's Judicial Administration Committee. And I'm going to start with a premise, which I think we probably, all of us would agree to, that we value a judiciary that ensures impartiality, integrity, and merit in the selection of our judges. And what we want is a process that ensures that that's going to continue. What we currently have is a vetting process that exists both on a state level and on a local level. And they're different processes because this isn't a one-size-fits-all process. Statewide selection of appellate judges is a statewide issue. These judges decide cases from all over the state. And the process in that case is made up of people from various parts of the state. I was fortunate enough to be asked to participate in the recent Oregon State Bar process on the selection of recommendations for the Supreme Court vacancy. And I was very impressed by the consideration and the breadth of qualifications that the various candidates brought to that process. The process was designed to be a merit process. It wasn't designed to be a political process. There was nothing political about the questions that were asked, about the reviews that were done on the various candidates. There were references checked and other contacts made to determine what the professional reputations were of the various candidates, as well as the interview process that was conducted. And those names then were forwarded to the governor. But that was one process. The governor certainly takes input from a variety of processes, and I think that if you actually looked at it, there's certainly a political cross-section of judges that are appointed by both Republican and Democratic governors, and it's not something that is politicized in that you only have persons of one persuasion appointed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Just out of curiosity, you mentioned the reference in the Supreme Court pool. You mentioned that candidates had references. Can you give us a flavor of what those references were? Were they judges? Were they other attorneys? Can you kind of give us a sense of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, I didn't personally conduct the reference checks because I was a member from the bar governors are the ones that did, but as I understand it, it was comprised of other judges, other practitioners, and even clients of the, and I think there were also some legislative members, as I recall.
Thank you.
As far as local circuit judges, the process has typically been a local process, and I think that's really appropriate. We have 36 counties in Oregon. We have almost as many judicial districts, and as each of you are well aware, the various areas of our state, the various counties, the various regions have very unique issues. Those vetting processes are very importantly local because they reflect that local flavor that is on the bench of each of those judicial districts. And I think that it's very important that that remain a local process. By requiring Senate confirmation, that would tend to support the one-size-fits-all, that we have one set of criteria that we're going to be looking at for judges. And I think that it does a disservice to the unique nature of the these different judicial districts that we have. Personally, I've appeared throughout the state in many of the different circuit courts as well as appellate courts. I have been impressed by the caliber of our judiciary, and I think that our current selection process has served the state, the people of Oregon, well since its inception. I don't think that times have changed. I don't think that there's anything before you that would cause you to question the wisdom of the framers of our Constitution, and I don't think there's any reason that we should be putting before the voters this proposal to change the selection process. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Barbara Fredericks.
Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you concerning House Joint Resolution 42. I'm Barbara Fredericks. I'm representing here today the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed citizen participation in government and provides voter education materials and activities. The League of Women Voters of Oregon opposes Joint House Resolution 42 for a number of reasons. First, HJR 42 would discourage qualified candidates for judicial office from applying for those positions. The proponents of HJR 42 have not offered any evidence that the current system of selecting judges is broken. Oregon's judicial selection system should encourage and attract people who are the most experienced and competent to hold judicial office. It should also be as free from political influence as possible. HJR 42 would have the opposite effect. Senate confirmation of the governor's appointees would burden the current judicial selection system with an additional and unnecessary layer of politics that will discourage highly qualified candidates from submitting themselves to the judicial selection process. The prospect of a partisan public debate in the Senate over the qualifications of an appointee for judicial office and the possibility of public rejection of the appointee by the Senate after such a debate will be harmful and discouraging to a prospective appointee. Unsuccessful applicants under the current process suffer no public embarrassment. The nature of the current process encourages qualified candidates who are not chosen by the governor to apply for future vacancies. Second, the Oregon Constitution gives the people the power to elect judges. Senate confirmation of the governor's appointments is unnecessary. Article 7, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution provides that the judges of the Supreme and other courts shall be elected by the legal voters of the state for a term of 6 years. Article 5, Section 16 provides that the governor's appointment to fill a vacancy in the office of judge shall expire when a successor has been elected and qualified. Section 16 goes on to provide that the vacancy shall be filled at the next general election. In the federal court system, by comparison, judges are appointed by the president to serve for life. The only check on the president's appointment of a federal judge is Senate confirmation. As Justice Gillette has testified now twice, in Oregon, the check for judicial office is the ballot box. No other state requires both election of judges and Senate confirmation. Third, House Joint Resolution Number 2 would upset the constitutional balance of power between the legislative and judicial branches of government. Article 3, Section 1 of Oregon's Constitution divides the powers of Oregon's government into three separate departments: the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. Article 5, Section 16 of the Constitution provides that when at any time a vacancy occurs in the office of judge of any court, the governor shall fill such vacancy by appointment, which shall expire when a successor has been elected and qualified. Article 3, Section 4 of the Constitution gives to the legislature the power to confirm all appointments to state public office and to any state elective office when the governor is authorized by law or this Constitution to fill any vacancy therein, except the office of judge of any court. HJR 42 would alter that balance of power and further extend the power of the legislature over the judicial department beyond the legislature's current power to fund the judicial department. HJR 42 would give to the legislature the additional power to control who will become a judge. The judiciary is an independent branch of Oregon's government and should not be subject to the excessive and overbearing control by the legislature that HJR 42 authorizes. Finally, HJR 42 will delay judicial appointments. Senate confirmation of the governor's appointments will be a roadblock to filling judicial vacancies. Unfilled judicial vacancies mean justice delayed or denied for Oregonians. Of 27 judicial districts in Oregon, 19 have 5 or fewer judges. 4 judicial districts have only 2 judges. 3 judicial districts have but 1 judge each. HJR 42 allows the legislature to delay judicial appointments by 4 months purely by inaction on a nomination. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on HJR 42.
Thank you, Barbara. And I would just say, appreciate your testimony today. Normally we ask that people not read their testimony verbatim, and the League is very good about coming here and sharing their opinions with us, and we appreciate it very much. But we do have 6 more people. You can see I'm starting to lose committee members, and I have another member who wanted to leave, and I've been whispering to her to please stay because we don't want to have you all testify to just one person up here and this committee staff. But we do want everybody to have their say, and we appreciate your testimony. Just next time, maybe to summarize it. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
David Fedanke is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, testifying in opposition to HJR 42. I want to be very clear that the ACLU does not support or oppose candidates for elective or appointive office here in Oregon, and the same is true at the federal level. With very rare exceptions, ACLU has taken positions on U.S. Supreme Court justices. As prior witnesses have testified, Madam Chair, this bill is quite a departure for Oregon, and when measured up against the federal system, we think is also quite different. As Justice Gillette pointed out, federal judges are appointed for life. We are not aware of any confirmation by the U.S. Senate or confirmation by the Oregon Senate of a state official or federal official who is subject to election. So this would be a major departure because, of course, judges are subject to later election, and appointed judges have to stand for election at the next regular election, which may be sooner than their term might normally have run. What's at stake here is the separation of powers. One of the most important protections of our freedom in our system of government. Those who framed the Oregon Constitution, those who framed the federal Constitution, did not trust putting very much power in the hands of any one individual or in the hands of any one branch of government. They wisely dispersed that power throughout the government. I was somewhat surprised that Representative Patridge referred to the Senate as the people's branch of government. I'm somewhat surprised that he didn't suggest confirmation by the House of Representatives, which, of course, is more representative of the people than the Senate, one could argue, because there are more of them. But what is there more of in our system of government than voters? Judges serve at the pleasure of voters every 6 years. And I would submit to you that the reason more incumbent judges haven't been thrown out of office is not because of the method of appointing judges when there are vacancies, but because of the number of judges who've been appointed who have been of very high qualifications and who have carried out their duties with great care and consideration. Now, obviously, the ACLU does not agree with every decision that's been handed down by judges in this state, and certainly not by judges of the Court of Appeals or the Oregon Supreme Court. But we recognize that the judicial branch and the independence of the judicial branch is critical in protecting the freedom of all Oregonians. We would strongly urge you not to mess around with that system, which is critical to protecting the freedoms of all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Well, I tend to agree with you on the separation of powers, but I was curious as to how you perceive the situation at the federal level where Supreme Court justices are subject to confirmation. What would you see as the difference?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Burke, number one, those judges at the federal level are appointed for life. Number two, the federal system is broken. Because of the tendency on the part of the last few presidents to try to go out of the mainstream in their appointment of judges, the mainstream of judicial thought and legal thought, they have made some very controversial appointments. And as a result, there has been increasing pressure on the United States Senate to scrutinize minutely the records of individuals who are appointed, who are nominated for federal judgeships. And as previous witnesses have testified, that has resulted in gridlock in the U.S. Senate with judicial appointments. I don't think that's a system we want to emulate. Now, to its credit, H.R. 42 and Grost responded to that criticism by putting an outer limit on how long the Senate could take in its consideration if this provision were added to the Constitution of 120 days. But I would submit to you that's not going to help that process because it will just increase the frustration when a controversial appointment is made. If you want to politicize the process, this will guarantee that it's politicized, because the tendency on the part of a nominee will be to say as little as possible about their record, and the tendency, as we've seen at the federal level more and more, the tendency of a governor under this system would be to appoint some people who don't have any track record that can be subject to attack by their political opponents. And the result, I believe, will be a weakened judicial branch, because you will have less qualified nominees being appointed solely because they have less experience, less of a public track record that can be attacked. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Madam Chair, can I?
Senator Brown.
David, talk to me about, you talked about judicial candidates running for office. One of the things that people, I think is a huge
benefit is the fact that judges run, I think, with an I behind their name, as I recall. So they're clearly identified as incumbents. Don't you think that's a huge advantage to these judges that are already sitting on the bench?
Madam Chair and Madam Co-Chair, I'm not sure that that's always an advantage. The courts are a frequent target for frustration of the public and certain political groups. And I honestly can't remember if the incumbent label still applies or whether that's been repealed. But that certainly is something that could be dealt with short of a constitutional amendment. There's nothing in the Constitution, I don't think, that requires an incumbent judge to be labeled as an incumbent on the ballot. But there have been some very vigorous campaigns, certainly at the appellate court level, in recent years, both where there were appointed judges and where there were incumbents running for re-election. Those contested races have certainly been in the minority, but they do occur, and certainly a well-organized campaigns have been mounted against incumbent judges. They haven't always succeeded. They may be very difficult, but I would again submit that the reason they're difficult is, on the one hand, because of the judicial canons, and on the other hand, because the incumbents that have been appointed or have been elected to open seats generally have been very well qualified.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. We have four more people. I'm going to close the public hearing. Don't leave. I'm going to close the public hearing on HJR 42A and open a work session on HCR 4A. Ask for any objections to allowing Senator Burdick to cast her vote on HCR 4A. Chair does not recognize Senator Bacher. Just kidding. Senator Burdick, how do you vote?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I vote yes.
Senator Burdick votes yes. Close the work session on HCR 4A and open a public hearing on HJR 42A. And the next person is Robert Neuberger and Judy Edwards.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Neuberger. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I have the honor of being the president-elect of the Multnomah Bar Association, which is a voluntary bar association like Oregon State Bar, which all lawyers in Oregon law practice have to belong to. The Multnomah Bar Association is a voluntary bar association. Approximately two-thirds of the lawyers in the Portland metropolitan area belong to our organization. We have been involved in the judicial, we call it screening process, because we don't select judges. We only comment to the decision makers. We've been involved for decades. We have a judicial screening committee that is like our bar association, composed of members of quite diverse backgrounds, both practice area, ethnic, gender, and the like. And we also have, we have 18 lawyers, we also have three public members on our committee. When it comes to circuit court vacancies in Multnomah County, our committee works on a set of very precise procedures that involve interviewing candidates, doing investigations, including talking to references, and then meeting as an entire committee to make recommendations to the governor of those applicants, those people seeking nomination, who are the most qualified. That is what we do as an organization. We are committed to the concept of merit selection of judges. That is why we oppose HJR 42A. In fact, we, in the last session, our then president, Senator Beyer's cousin, Ruth Beyer, who happens to be the managing partner at Still Reeves in Portland, and I testified in favor of what was then HJR 7, which was Representative Williams' bill, which worked off the work started in 1999 by Chairman Neil Bryant. chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, what started out looking at this issue, and I'm sorry, but I'm a history major, and I learned that those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. And when faced with a similar proposal in 1999, Chairman Bryant looked at the issue and did a lot of work. In fact, he did so much work that his staff member was invited to attend a conference put forward by the ABA, the American Bar Association, to talk about the whole subject. That's how knowledgeable they are about it. I originally, in the Multnomah Bar Association board, originally opposed the idea of merit selection commissions, but Chairman Bryant and Chairman Williams on the House side were so persuasive, and they crafted such a really a good proposal that we as an organization, along with the Oregon State Bar, supported it. We think HJR 42 or 42A or whatever letter number it has now goes in absolutely the wrong direction. If you want, I would encourage you to look at what was HJR 7, which, interestingly, passed the House in the last session. It involves a system of merit selection commissions. And our main objection to it was it only provided for one around the state. We thought each county or judicial district got to have their own. Because different areas of the state know each their own area better. I want to talk a minute about, we talk about judicial independence, we talk about judicial impartiality, we talk about separation of powers, and those are all important concepts. And I want to let you know what I'm about to say, as long as you don't tell him I stole this from Justice Gillette, because he said it the other night, and Senator Brown heard this. It's why are those important? You know, if we were talking about a ball game, we wouldn't want to pick the umpire or the referees based upon their politics or who they knew. We'd want the best umpires or referees. That's what merit selection is about. Why is it important? Why is it important to Oregonians? There's been a lot of talk and very interesting articles and pieces in the paper because of what's gone on overseas about how do you start a democracy. And I would have thought the most important thing were elections right off. And the people who studied it found that the two most important things are a free market economy, that is capitalism, and the rule of law. Rule of law means an independent, impartial judiciary, a judicial branch of government, an independent branch, answerable to a rule of law, not to something else, not to politics. Now, there are other branches of government where politics are absolutely what those branches should be answerable to. But it's different for the judiciary. And that's what has made Oregon and its judiciary a wonderful place. Because, as Justice Gillette says, yes, there are times that we've had some lesser lights, and there are times when we've had greater lights, but for the most part, we've had excellent people wearing the robe. And we should be very careful about upsetting that balance, that has worked so well. The people of Oregon have shown that they are quite capable of judging judges. And the fact that we don't have contested judicial elections in each election does not mean that the system is not working. In fact, I would suggest to you that means that the system is working well, that it's the appointment system and the people are there. Because you'd only wouldn't turn out a well-qualified judge just because you wanted somebody new. If they're doing the job right, then merit selection is working. I was just sitting in the back of the hearing room while Representative Patridge was saying we don't have contested elections. I counted 6 or 7 contested Supreme Court races just in the time I've been a lawyer. I counted 4, well, or more than that, because Union County, they're always throwing out their judge, at the trial level. We've had more than that on the Court of Appeals. So it's a misnomer to say we don't have contested elections. When it's appropriate, they happen. And to say that no one's going to run against a sitting judge because they have to appear in front of them is not accurate either, because you don't have to appear in front of that judge. You have an absolute right to say, I don't want to appear in front of a particular judge in this state. And so that's simply not a problem. The reason you don't have them is when merit selection works. And, in fact, we've had times when the legislature has created judgeships and didn't want to give the governor the power of appointment. We had one up in Multnomah County a couple years ago, and I don't think that the legislature intended that they wanted Senator Wires to be the one to win that election. He might have been a different result if it had been merit selection. I'm not here to judge that, but I think we ought to be careful about the unintended consequences of what happens in these things.
Madam Chair, I groan because the quality of that election because I remember specifically the battle at the legislature whether this was going to be appointed or an election process, and the quality of that election was so poor and so grim, I was embarrassed that we had an election process take place. I mean, it was horrible. So, I can't remember, 2000, 98?
It was approximately 4+ years ago.
Yeah. So, okay, continue. Sorry for that commentary.
Our committee. Our Multnomah Bar Association Judicial Screening Committee has worked off, as I mentioned before, a set of very precise procedures and criteria. And I think it's interesting that we haven't heard either on the House side or in the hearing today from the proponents one judge, one appointment, who was a person who wasn't well qualified, or somehow that the system failed it, or who wasn't, as we heard the word, vetted. I think that HJR 42A and the Multnomah Bar Association would urge you, goes in the wrong direction. That if we're going to make any changes, that would be in the area of merit selection commissions. Mr. Denneke was a little too modest about the American Judicature Society. Just recently, it bestowed its annual award. It gives one. And there are chapters all around the country. And based on his nomination, that award went jointly to Senator Gordon Smith and Senator Ron Wyden. And there were quite a discussion about the principles of merit selection, of picking judges based upon the process. You know, we had an election, and the last time we had two ballot measures, 21 and 22. There was over $1.5 million spent on those two measures, getting them on the qualifying them for the ballot and trying to get them passed, and the Oregon voters said no. And to say that 42A will not inject politics into the system in a place in a way it doesn't deserve ignores recent history. Thank you very much.
A question, Senator Brown.
Robert, you said there have been 6 or 7 contested Supreme Court cases since you've been practicing. How long have you been practicing?
thank you. Since September of 1980, Chair Barno, Vice Chair Brown, since September of 1980. So for 22 and a half years.
Madam Chair, one other question.
Another question.
Why did HJR 7 pass?
I'm sorry?
HJR 7 must have stalled in the Senate. Did the Senate Judiciary Committee not support it?
I have to admit, Co-Chair Clarence, Co-Chair Brown, I have to admit I didn't get an opportunity to go back and look at that part of the history, and my memory isn't good enough to even begin to guess why. I remember we came down and Ruth Beyer and I came down and testified along with Ed Harnan, who was then president of the Oregon State Bar, and I don't know what happened to it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Susan Russell next.
Madam Chair, Member of Committee, Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here in opposition to House Joint Resolution 42. I will be very brief in my comments. I concur with all the testimony that has been presented to you here today and the concerns that have been raised by the various parties that have so much experience with the judicial selection process. It is our opinion that the House Joint Resolution 42, if passed, would weaken the strong and independent Oregon judiciary that this state has. The current judicial appointment process works. It works well. It works well with the appointment being made initially by the governor, with the appointed judge being required to stand for election at least every 6 years. This contrasts strongly with the federal system where appointments are for life, has been repeatedly emphasized, and there is no election process. The election process is a check and balance here, and it's a check and balance that works. We have grave concerns that House Joint Resolution 42 would further politicize the process of judicial appointments and would seriously erode and compromise judicial independence, which is a grave concern, as I say, particularly for an organization like ours, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, who are often in position representing individuals upon whom there is a tremendous amount of political pressure for judges to conform their rules or their sentences to public pressures and not to withstand such matters. And so for those reasons, we are here in opposition and urge you not to pass this resolution.
Thank you, Susan. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Dole.
Madam Chairs, and I guess there are no committee members. My name is Steve Dole, for the record. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. However, I'm here today not testifying on behalf of Crime Victims United. I'm testifying as a citizen of the state of Oregon. I have just a few comments I'd like to make on the bill. And as far as the bill goes, I support this bill, and I will tell you why. And I have thought about this in the past, and I know this has come forward in the past, but I think it at least gives the people a voice in the process through their elected representatives as to who sits on the bench. Now, there are other things I'd rather see done to the elected process when it comes to judges, but there's been a lot of things that have been said today, and I'd like to comment on a few of them. First of all and foremost, I think when Representative Patridge says you can't have it both ways, he said it very well. And that's what's going on in this state when it comes to the elective process for judges. We have a hybrid system that's neither. It's neither fish nor fowl, as the old saying goes. It really isn't elective. It really isn't appointive. It's something that's in between. And it doesn't surprise me that the legal establishment and the elite from the legal establishment is in this hearing room today, all opposing this thing. Of course they are. When the people of Oregon are polled around this issue and given some prompts about whether they elect their judges or not, at first bite they'll say they elect their judges. But when they're given some other questions about surrounding how judges get on the bench and if there really are elections, they realize that it is an appointive system. And how some in the room have given testimony that the judges serve at the behest of the voters, I find to be almost laughable. Over the last, and I have to say, I've participated in both the appointment and the election of judges. I've asked judges who want to be appointed to the bench to sit down and talk to me about their appointment. And it always is bemuses me or amuses me when you say, well, how do you feel about Measure 11? Well, I can't comment on that, but I'll certainly uphold the Constitution of Oregon. How do you feel about victims' rights? Well, I really can't comment on that, but I'll uphold. So 2 hours later into the conversation, what you've got is that they'll uphold the Constitution of Oregon because they can't say anything. I've participated in retail elections, but those are elections where as the previous testimony stated, the legislature opened up a seat, and it had to be an election. Now, what I can tell you is this. We did a little study on this thing, and what we know is this, is 87% of the judges are sitting today on the bench got there originally by an appointment. We know that in the last three election cycles, there have been 7 or 8 judges who have been opposed, who are incumbent judges. They're all still sitting there, because the people that opposed them lost those races. And I would suggest to you that part of that has to do with the power of the incumbency. Imagine yourself if you've got to put an incumbent behind your name on the ballot and in the voter's pamphlet. I've had people who run elections, who do polling, who are involved in retail politics, tell me that incumbency is worth 12 to 17 points at the polls right off the top. It's that powerful. Now, how did we come by that? Well, it came about because there was some discussion 1 year about the judges' salaries, and in lieu of a salary raise, they got incumbency. Well, since then, they've got salary raises, but the incumbency never came off the ballot. So I would say, the Lord taketh and the Lord giveth. And maybe the Lord, being the legislature, needs to take it again, although I would suggest to you I would do that in a constitutional amendment so it goes away and stays away forever, because it'll just come back again otherwise. I know that most of the establishment who's sitting out there don't like anything what I have to say, but they probably will like this. The thing I'd really like to see done, now if we're up to Steve Dole to run the judicial election process, here's what I'd do. I'd take away that incumbency, and I'd have a Missouri plan. So we have, so we're able to, when we have a judge who isn't doing their job, to have a people's voice entered into the process. And what I mean, I didn't like the none of the above that was on the ballot last time. And I might also make a comment that the one other act, the districting act that Mr. Neuberger mentioned earlier, of the two acts that were on the ballot, while they both failed, the districting act was one of the closest races in initiative history. It only failed by 0.4 points, and 32 out of 36 counties voted for it. And if you pull Multnomah County out of that, it won by 34,000 plus votes. So, what I was,
Madam Chair, that's probably true with the governor's race too, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I'm just stating the facts, Senator. I'm just stating. Although no, we won more counties than Mr. Mannix did. But here's what I would do. I'd put in a Missouri system where you have Judge Smith on the ballot, and then you have the question: shall Judge Smith be retained? Yes or no? I will tell you this, and I hate to say this because I hate to be, well, I'll just say it. One of the judges I interviewed for his position at one time, who I sat with for 2 hours over lunch and basically told me nothing except that he'd support the Constitution, which I guess is a good thing, we have found that this judge on a continual basis has DUI defendants in front of him who, when they have four or more offenses, when they're supposed to turn them into felonies, puts them out on probation when they're supposed to go to a felony and do some prison time. The last one we had in front of this judge, this one person had over 8 DUIs, and he put him into treatment and probation when the law says you're supposed to send him off to prison with that many DUIs. It's very troublesome. We went to the presiding judge. The presiding judge did nothing. What really troubles me, and I hate to say this about people, is that I ran into this judge one night on the street coming out of a restaurant. I said hello to him. He was so drunk, he didn't recognize me. So what do you do when you have a situation like that? You go to the Judicial Fitness Committee. You have DAs complain. You complain as citizens. No, you have to do it at the ballot box. But what I was getting to, and I'll finish up here, I'll draw this to a close, is the thing that the people out here who object to all this will probably like to hear me say, and I'm going to say it. I think what we should have is a discussion with the public, and the discussion should be put to them by the legislature in a constitutional amendment. Shall we elect our judges, as the Constitution now says, or shall we appoint them? Let's just do one or the other. But let's cut out this hybrid process where neither one is happening. Because the fact of the matter is, if I could go in and get an appointment as a judge tomorrow, which unfortunately I can't do because, number one, I'm not a lawyer, but number two, I doubt if I was a lawyer I could get that appointment. The fact of the matter is that we need to have an open process if we're going to have elections, and one by which the people can speak. And this bill at least gives the people some type of a voice. If we're not going to take the incumbency away, if we're not going to have a Missouri plan like a lot of states do, that's basically a retention, a yes or no, and if we can't open up the parameters of speech a little bit to find out who those people are up there in front of us that are in those black robes, because Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, these are the people that you're most likely to come into contact with as a citizen. Most citizens don't talk to their mayor or their local rep or their senator or the governor. But whether it's a traffic ticket or a property dispute or a divorce or something worse, criminal case, I can tell you that's the person in government that you're most likely to come in contact with. And I thank you for your time, and I appreciate it, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick, do you have any questions? No, thank you. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, the committee members that are here. I appreciate your patience, and we are adjourned.